This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. For more than 30 years, the Wildlife Center of Virginia has been treating injured animals and releasing them back into the wild. That work has garnered much praise around the world, but now there's international attention on another front. The center's success is cementing public support through use of internet portals. One reason why hundreds of nonprofit organizations lined up to hear what the center's founder had to say during his recent travels across Russia. Of course, whenever Ed Clark stops by, there are all manner of fascinating stories about all manner of fascinating animals. And we are sure to get some of those today. But if nonprofit groups halfway across the globe are eager to hear how the Wildlife Center has made such success of social media, maybe there's something valuable on that topic we could learn too. We find out right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. But here's the thing. Whenever Ed Clark's around, you're tempted to just want to sit back and listen. Sure, hundreds of questions are likely to pop to mind, but you may feel you should not interrupt. On the other hand, you could take pity on me, because I have the same problem when listening to Ed, and I might end up not asking what you most want to hear him address. So, just in case there could be something in the hour ahead about wild animals, about the state of the environment, or even about how to better use social media more effectively, such things that might strike you as important, please do mark down this number in all numbers, 888-967-2825. Founder and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, Ed Clark, great to see you back in the Insight studio.
Hey, Tom, nice to be here. Now, were you saying that nobody can get a word in edgewise when I was speaking? Was that
your point? No, I was saying that we're mesmerized.
Okay.
And it's difficult to remember that we're supposed to add to the conversation.
And I forgot to wear boots this afternoon. So.
Well, let's start with an easy one. What is the Wildlife Center of Virginia?
Well, the Wildlife Center of Virginia is a nonprofit organization that is essentially a teaching and research hospital for wildlife medicine. And by that, I mean that we are a facility that cares for injured animals, orphaned animals, animals that are displaced by one or another human intervention. And we do everything we can to restore them to good health and normal behavior and return them to the wild. But in the process of doing that, we are a teaching facility first and foremost. So in caring for the animals, we are providing training to fourth-year veterinary students from every single vet school in the United States and Canada, and from nearly 40 other countries. Our students come to the facility in Waynesboro to learn how to apply the general skills of veterinary medicine to the very specialized practice of wildlife and conservation medicine. Now, when I say we're a research facility, we're not doing little tests on the animals and putting little probes in and all of that stuff that gets people all freaked out on the internet. What we are doing are clinical studies. Every animal that comes in the door, and there are nearly 3,000 every year that come to the Wildlife Center, every one of them has come in because of one or another problem they've encountered in the environment. Now, sometimes it's simple stuff. Birds fall from the nest. That's normal. That's natural. Unfortunately, there are all too many house cats running around out there, which are not natural. But animals come in from that type of thing. There's not really any huge overarching mystery behind those types of injuries and those types of patients coming to our doors. But every now and then we find animals that come in with neurologic symptoms that are not associated with a collision or some obvious injury. And we have to then investigate and find out what has caused these symptoms and then determine whether or not the cause of those symptoms in this individual animal is a threat that still remains in the environment. And if so, how we need to respond, whether by notifying authorities, responding ourselves firsthand on the scene, or in some way responding in a larger scale, perhaps by plugging a hole that exists in public policy or state or federal law.
You and two or three other people got this all started 32 years ago?
Yeah, it's In some ways, it seems like yesterday, and it was the last century. But
how come? What got you in on this?
Well, it was a situation that was sort of the perfect storm. My three colleagues with whom I started this, the other three were all veterinary professionals. My background was in conservation organization
and
management.
Teaching.
And teaching. I had been a teacher. Did my graduate work in education. After graduating from Bridgewater College, I did graduate work at both JMU and UVA in education. But my heart was in conservation. And during the early 80s, Stuart Porter, the director of the Veterinary Technology Program at Blue Ridge Community College, who I understand has just recently retired after a long and very distinguished career in teaching, Stuart was a former zoo vet before he became a teacher at Blue Ridge, and people found out about that, started bringing him injured and orphaned wildlife. But unfortunately, at the college, he had no place to keep them, and he was often forced to send them back home with people who were both unqualified and untrained to provide the continuing care. So we happened to be together one afternoon over coffee, and he was kind of accounting this lament, and I, being a consultant in the nonprofit world at that time, said, well, here's what you need to do. You need to start a nonprofit. You need to, raise money, and somebody will donate this and donate that. And I will say that Stuart's response to my advice dripped of skepticism, if not cynicism. And so the testosterone poisoning kicked in with an I'll show you. And the bottom line is the four of us founded the Wildlife Center. It was incorporated in early November of 1982. So we are coming up on our 32nd anniversary. During that time, we've now cared for more than 65,000 wild animals. We've given face-to-face education programs with probably 1.6 million people, mostly children, but children of all ages, shall we say. And through our social media, we have literally reached tens of millions worldwide.
Well, to you on the other side of your radio, do you have a favorite wild animal? How to get to be your favorite. Got a story about your own experiences in the wild that you'd be willing to share? And we've got this Ed from Carrie already up on our Facebook page, and she says, why can't a way to test for rabies be found without killing the animal?
Well, we're asked that many, many times, and unfortunately, rabies is a neurologic disease, a virus that affects the brain and the central nervous system. And really, the only way to test for it that is currently known is to sample brain tissue. And short of actually doing a biopsy on the brain, which would probably result in the death of an animal anyway, the really conclusive test is to do the removal of the brain, cutting very, very thin slices of brain tissue, and then staining it in a certain way and looking at those stained samples under an electron microscope. Viruses are exceedingly small organisms, and they really have to be seen under just the right circumstances or they will be missed. And quite honestly, the decision has been heavily weighed in the favor of erring on the side of accuracy. Because the consequences of being wrong in the diagnosis is somebody dies. There is no known recovery from rabies. There are a few people who have had severe central nervous system disorders, and they recovered. It was thought to be rabies, but until you remove the brain of the person, and there are not many living brain donors out there who are not in, public office in Washington, as some people would cynically say, but it really is a matter of being absolutely sure.
So what you're saying is if there's an animal that's suspected of possibly having rabies,
absolutely,
it is putting humans and lots of other animals at risk.
Potentially, that is exactly so. And in fact, we had a case here in Harrisonburg many years ago. A fellow brought in a young raccoon. His children had been keeping it as a pet. Apparently, the mother had legitimately been killed on the highway, and they picked up this baby raccoon. brought it home and had kept it for a couple of months. And it was about, 3 or 4 months old, probably 4 or 5 months old, actually. It had been sleeping with the kids and playing with the kids, and all the neighbors had come in to see it. And then finally somebody either dropped a dime on them and turned them in or whatever happened. He brought it to the Wildlife Center. We accepted it with a smile. And as soon as he left the building, we euthanized it, sent the brain away for testing to see if it indeed was rabid, since there had been so much human exposure. And raccoons and skunks are the two species that can carry the virus without actually showing symptoms. Well, the guy called back the next day to see how his raccoon was and was told by the front desk staff, in all innocence, well, it had to be euthanized and tested for rabies. Well, the guy went berserk. He was going to burn the building down and beat me up and sue us and get our permits pulled and blah, blah, blah. And eventually the test came back positive. The animal had rabies. There were 8 children and 4 adults that had had extensive exposure to that animal. And had we not done that, some or all of those children and adults may well have died. We do not equivocate on that point. We do not place human life at a lower level or on the same level with animal life. We're in the business of saving animals, but at no time will we compromise human health and safety in the pursuit of that goal.
Not to get stuck on this issue of rabies, because we've got lots of other things to get to, but I just want to double check what you were saying about animals having to be euthanized in order for the kind of test that needs to be done to determine if it had rabies. You actually cannot determine in a human being if it has rabies without the same thing.
Correct. And the bottom line is, if a human being begins to show symptoms, it's already too late.
And that's why if a human being is bit, I had a relative some years ago who was bit by a bat, no indication of whether or not the bat was rabid, but he had to have rabies shots.
Right. The post-exposure vaccinations are a way to inoculate the potential victim against the potential risk.
I guess one of the things that Carrie is hinting at in her question here on our Facebook page is, are we going to get to the point, do you think, where we'll be able to have a test that tells human or other animal if it has been exposed to something that gives us pause, we can determine whether or not rabies is actually in that animal?
Well, I guess it boils down to marketplace motivation. And truthfully, the majority of people who have to undergo post-exposure vaccination are not bitten by wildlife, they're bitten by cats. And that's one of the big issues with this whole debate over feral cat colonies and free roaming cats and all of this, really drawing of lines in the sand. The cat advocates are saying that cats should be treated with some sort of reverence, even though they're free roaming in the wild. And the truth is, about 80% of the humans who have to take these post-exposure shots have been bitten by cats, not skunks, not raccoons, not foxes, not bats. But, this is really one of the big deals. And the thing is, eventually got to come down to what gives us the greatest assurance for the protection of human health and safety. Yes, we're definitely concerned about the animal's welfare. Yes, we're definitely concerned about not taking the lives of animals that aren't infected, but given the options, we're going to always place the priority on human health and safety.
Environmental activist, wildlife rescue specialist, professional consultant, and motivational speaker, and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, Ed Clark, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I gotta ask you about critter cams. And not everybody knows what a critter cam is, so we'll certainly get to the basics on that, but we have to pause for a break and lots of other questions as well. I believe Sally in Richmond is going to be our first call when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Somewhere in our audience right now is someone whose understanding of and concerns about wildlife and the environment were radically altered because of some personal experience they had. Our guest, Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. I'm Tom Graham from Richmond. Sally, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yes. In the local paper, they mentioned that an African spur thigh tortoise was found in a local city park. And it was taken to a couple of places, a vet, and then it ended up at a rehabber in Dinwiddie County. And in the article, they end the article after talking about the way the turtle looks and how big it is and how long it can live, up to 100 years. It says that to claim the tortoise or adopt it, call the person at the rehabber. And I'm pretty sure Ed Clark would not think that would be a good idea. I mean, if it's someplace
okay.
like a zoo or, you know, some place that's going to keep the turtle, because I don't think they're sending it back to Africa, wherever it came from.
Well, your question is a good one, and it certainly leads us into a larger topic. But more specifically, this particular turtle, the trouble is that people buy these exotic pets. They buy these little tortoises when they're tiny. They can get them in pet stores. They are imported specifically to be pets. And the African spur tortoise can eventually weigh well over 100 pounds. We actually had one brought to us many years ago from the Charlottesville, Virginia area. And that turtle was the size of a wastebasket and a very interesting animal. I mean, we kept him in the hospital and he would chase people down the hall trying to beg treats. They're actually a lot smarter than people give them credit for. But unfortunately, you know, when people get something small, they want to put it in an aquarium, and that's fine, and they feed it, and then it grows, and they have to get someplace bigger. And the trouble is a lot of students in particular get these things, and they outgrow the student apartment, or parents buy them for their children. They outgrow the confinement potential in the kids' room, or people just plain get tired of them. And they take them to the park and turn them loose. They, of course, by the very name, the African spurred tortoise is a native species of Africa. They actually are interesting pets. The trouble is they're going to outlive the owners in almost every case. And therein lies the problem. People get these animals. They don't really know what they're getting. They have some sort of fantasized imagination about what the relationship with this animal is going to be, and it very seldom works out that way. The same problem exists with cetaceans, parrots, macaws, conures, birds like that. A macaw can live 80 to 85 years. So anybody who is over 40 years of age who buys one of these things as a chick either needs to truly have in mind how they're going to handle it upon their demise, or they really must hate their children if they're going to leave it to their kids, because these animals don't transfer ownership very easily, and particularly the birds, very intelligent, but they become very attached to one person. If that person's not there, whoever ends up with this bird is probably not going to have a very enjoyable time with it. So exotic pets in general are typically pursued and purchased because of some sort of ego interest or desire to be different. But truthfully, we strongly, strongly advise people to go to their local animal shelter. If you want something to love, get something that'll love you back. Go adopt a puppy. Go adopt a kitten. And if you're going to find if you really have your heart set on an exotic pet, go to the local animal shelter and adopt one like this tortoise that has been cast off by its original owner. Don't go out and buy new ones. It stimulates the trade. It spurs the strip mining of these animals from their natural habitat. Anybody that tells you that they're all bred in captivity either is sorely misinformed or is not someone who is suffering from an overdose of integrity, because there is still a huge, huge international black market in wildlife all over the world.
Sally, thank you so very much for your call. Next to Penn Laird, Sandra, your question or comment for Wildlife Center of Virginia President Ed Clark, please.
Hi, Ed. I could go on and on with compliments, but I know that that's already understood by the audience listening to this.
Oh, I'm not sure if you'd like to, share 5 or 10 minutes worth. No, never mind. Go ahead.
a really big problem with the cat overpopulation. Dogs have it bad, but the cat overpopulation, because of their ability to take so much food from wild predators that the domestic cats don't need and should be feeding the wild predators. This is a terrible, terrible problem. And I watch our local SPCAs year in and year out being funded generously, I think, $250,000 from each from both municipalities, being generously funded and doing absolutely nothing of significance to educate the public or to actively spay neuter everything they get their hands on if they're going to keep it for adoption. I just don't know. I think that this overpopulation problem is a community health problem. It's a community nuisance problem. How do you make local legislators understand that this is no joke and that people like me and my friends are suffering a terrible financial, emotional, and actually physical burden by taking care of these animals, trying to find indoor homes for them, trying to keep them out of the loop of, you know, stealing food from wild animals that need it.
Sandra, I need you to hold on so Ed can respond to what you've said so far.
Okay. Well, Sandra, you're touching on one of the great public policy debates in natural resource management that is raging nationwide right now. We certainly all agree that there is an overpopulation of domestic cats in the United States. There really is no difference of opinion on that point. There's great difference of opinion as to the range of the actual population size of house cats or domestic cats in the United States. Now,
Wasn't it just last year that there was yet another study saying that as many as a billion birds a year in America are being killed by house cats?
That's absolutely true. And in fact, we are finalizing a study at the Wildlife Center right now, looking back on 11 or 12 years of data, really thousands and thousands of wild animals that have come into the Wildlife Center, and analyzing the impact of cats on our own patients. Now, we're not generalizing this to the world. We're just saying, here's what we've seen. And what we are finding is that of the birds that come in, a very significant percentage, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of the birds that come in are direct victims of cats. And the mortality of those that have been attacked by cats, regardless of the severity of their injury, is over 80%. Now, these are birds that survive the attack and make it to a hospital, and still the mortality is over 80%. The truth is that if that cat breaks the skin of a wild animal with tooth or claw, the infection that is subsequent to that puncture wound of any type is almost certainly going to be fatal. With mammals, again, very high percentage of the animals coming in are cat victims. With certain of the species, it is the leading cause of presentation at the Wildlife Center for care, and the mortality is over 70% for mammals.
What I'm getting from Sandra, I think, Ed Clark, is she's wondering if you have any suggestions for what can be done to change the situation.
Well, I think, there are a number of things, none of which are easy answers. There are those who believe that you capture these free-ranging cats, the feral cats, the unowned cats, you neuter them, you vaccinate them, and then you take them and turn them loose again. Now, those of us who view this public policy issue from the wildlife point of view say that that cat has no place in the environment, and by releasing that cat into the environment, you are choosing the cat's life over the life of the potentially hundreds of other wild animals it will kill during its lifetime. And it doesn't kill because it's hungry. People say, oh, well, we feed them. They don't need to hunt. Well, need has nothing to do with it. It is an
So it sounds like you're offering what some people are going to see as a fairly controversial suggestion, and that is feral cats should be euthanized.
Feral cats should not be returned to the wild. Euthanasia is one, but a long way from the only option available. Certainly, the cats that can be socialized, especially young ones, kittens, whatever, definitely should not be released to the wild. They should be socialized and adopted. There are cat sanctuaries which actually confine cats within a cat-proof fenced-in area. There are lots of ways in which we can respond to this overpopulation without simply throwing up our hands and saying, oh, it's the cat's instinct, therefore it's nature. It's not nature. The domestic cat is not a natural predator anywhere in the world, and certainly not in North America. There is no prey species that has evolved with a defense mechanism against cats. Cats are ubiquitous killers. They will catch mice, sure. You know, that's great, and that's the fantasy that goes along with people letting these cats go out. They're controlling the mouse population.
But it sounds like one of the things that you're saying in response to Sandra's question is that we do need some public policy changes about how to deal with feral cats, and at least to deal in some ways with feral cats.
Well, the truth is most animal control departments in Virginia and across the country won't respond to a feral cat call.
You'd like to see that change.
Well, in most cases, the law requires them to. They just choose not to, and nobody's making a point about it.
I need to stop you there because we're getting so many other questions for you. Sandra, thank you so very much for your call. Anne and Crozet, we're going to get to you next, but first I need to ask Ed a question because it relates to other questions that we've got coming in. Explain, please. What is a critter cam?
The critter cam. It's a name we coined for our streaming live video that comes out of the Wildlife Center day in and day out. That we actually have 17 cameras throughout the Wildlife Center and three channels of live streaming video of our patients in our facility. Some of them are on our little black bears. We've got a bunch of baby owls. We have eagles. We have a lot of different things. And we switch them around based on where the action happens to be on any given day. But I understood just before coming up here that we have fallen victim to a nuisance wildlife issue. Apparently a mouse got into our control box and chewed through the power cord on the circuit box that controls our critter cam. So our IT specialist was there as I left, fixing it up and mouse-proofing our box. So even we who are the supposedly top experts on this field fall victim to the animals we care about.
I am saying nothing about any form of irony, but I am going to ask you about some of the things you discussed relative to what you just talked about when you were in Russia recently, after I let everybody listening know that they are listening to Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, on Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and we next have Anne in Crozet on the line. Anne, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, I'm wondering if you have some advice. We have a small brown bird I haven't identified who has a nest with babies in it in the bucket, a storage bucket of our grill. And it's the 4th of July weekend, and we're supposed to use the grill, but I don't want baked birdies. If I unhook the bucket, can I move it? Will she find it, or do we just have to go with plan B?
Well, the truth is that, first of all, it's probably a wren. They are notorious for building nests in very inopportune and inconvenient places. I had to surrender my kayak for about 6 weeks. I had it hanging upside down, and she had gone in through the hole and built her nest in there. You actually can, if it's in a bucket, you actually can move it a short distance. If you're going to be using the grill, you literally can take the bucket, set it in a safe, convenient place, use the grill, and put the bucket back, and the bird will come right back to it.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the work y'all do over there.
Thank you for calling in, and have a great 4th of July weekend.
Russia?
Russia, big place, big subject. Just got home.
See, I know I don't have to say more than one word, and you're going to give us a story.
Well, I mean, I can sit here and stare at you if that would make for better radio.
All right, let me be a little bit more specific. You were in Russia in large part because so many organizations have been impressed with what the Wildlife Center of Virginia has been accomplishing with social media.
Well, social media and a lot of other things. Actually, we were contacted back at the end of April by the staff of the Humane Society International, which is a sister organization, a subsidiary organization of the Humane Society of the United States, the largest animal welfare group in the United States. Over the years, I've done a lot of training for them. I've spoken at more than a dozen conferences that they have either sponsored or convened, and they know me. They know the Wildlife Center very, very well. They were contacted by an organization in Russia that was creating a conference on fundraising for what are called outside the United States. We call them nonprofits here, but NGOs or non-governmental organization. Nonprofit is actually a designation of an organization related to its tax status.
And I understand that these groups, and I think there were hundreds, that came to hear you speak at different places in Russia, almost none of them had anything to do with wildlife. Many of them were human rights organizations.
Well, in fact, there were only two that were directly or indirectly related to wildlife out of the literally hundreds.
So what did you have to tell these people about how to be more successful at staying afloat based on what you've learned at the Wildlife Center?
Well, the fact that the Wildlife Center has such a strong relationship with its friends and supporters is not simply because we care for wildlife. There are thousands of organizations across the United States that care for wildlife, and the overwhelming majority of them are broke and really circling the drain. I hear it every time I go to a conference, whining and crying and, oh, woe is us because people aren't giving us money. And what I learned early on in my career, the first law of fundraising is nobody gives you money because you need money. Everybody needs money. The only reason people will donate to an organization is because the organization has convinced them they will take those contributions, do something worthwhile with those contributions, and then make the donor feel good about having contributed by reporting back. And
sounds like a great philosophy, Ed. Tell me about the practical aspects of how you do it that translate to other organizations.
Well, one of the most overwhelming experiences or sort of feelings that I came away bearing from Russia had nothing to do with Russia per se, but it had to do with a sharpened awareness of how the team, and it is a team, at the Wildlife Center of Virginia operates. We have truly built a culture in which our donors and supporters are part of the team. They are quite literally our partners in what we do. Most nonprofit organizations view the people that contribute money as some sort of herd of cows that can be milked periodically so that the important people, the people working for the organization, can do whatever it is they want to do. That's a self-defeating attitude. It's a little on the arrogant side, and it's certainly not destined for success.
So it sounds like a large part of what you had to say is if you've got the right philosophy towards your potential donors, success will follow.
It certainly, well, it doesn't necessarily follow, but unless you have the right philosophy, it's guaranteed to stay away.
We're going to continue with Ed Clark of the Wildlife Center of Virginia in just a bit more than 1 minute. So, to join us here on Virginia Insight, you can dial in at 888-WMRA-TALK or post to the Virginia Insight Facebook page where we're listed at WMRA's Virginia Insight. Treating injured wild animals, preventing injury to wild animals, protecting the environment, and even using social media to get people more connected to your cause, whatever your cause is. Those are just some of the topics we are covering today. Ed Clark of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, we have this on our Facebook page from Linnell, who says, when an eaglet starves to death on a critter cam, wildlife rehab folks say that this is nature and we should not intervene. Are there formal guidelines on when rehabbers will intervene and when they will not?
Sure. Yeah, and yes, there are. And they're not only guidelines. In many cases, it's actually state and or federal law. The proliferation of these internet cameras on bird nests and bear dens and just about anything else of which you can think has created a tremendous pool of constituents for for wild animals and wild species. So when there's an eagle cam, a camera on a nest, people will sometimes spend hours and hours and hours every single day watching the eagles when they lay their eggs, when the eggs hatch, when the babies begin to grow and develop. But unfortunately, a lot of times, nature's not always a well-scripted place. Walt Disney simply did not write the script for the truly natural world, and not every animal survives. And in fact, with eagles, only 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 4 will actually make it through to maturity. So at least 75% will not survive in the first 5 years of their lives. And that's a difficult thing to wrap your mind around, especially birds as beautiful and majestic as eagles. But it's also a very, very difficult thing to watch. And what we try hard to get people to understand is the placement of the camera on a nest does not make that nest or its occupants special in any way other than it is known. Here in Virginia, we have somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 nesting pairs of bald eagles. We had a camera on one particular nest in the Norfolk, Virginia area, and that created such a huge amount of interest. And indeed, when the federal government determined that that nest needed to be removed because it was adjacent to the Norfolk International Airport, there was a huge, huge outcry that somehow this nest was special, that these eagles should not be bothered or in any way harassed. They should move the airport. And people were making some statements that were just frankly irrational. But it was not because they weren't rational people. It was because of their emotional investment in this particular pair of eagles and their offspring. And we're seeing that. So the origin of this question goes to one of the webcams that was on an eagle's nest this year, in which the pair had two chicks in the nest, one of which was significantly larger than the other. And there are lots of reasons. The eggs are laid 4 or 5 days apart. Sometimes the parents will immediately begin to incubate. Sometimes they won't. But this one chick was the runt, and the larger chick took all the food. There is no share and share alike in the wild world. Nature's view is that it's better for one to survive than for both to simply get an equal portion and be substandard adults. So the natural world is not always an easy thing to watch, and some people, frankly, just can't deal with it. But the law says rehabilitation is the care and nurture and healing of an animal so that it can be returned to the wild to take up its natural place in the environment. Being the victim of natural processes with no human interference, no human stimulation, that is not a scenario under which normally rehabilitation is justified.
And Clark, you told me sometime back that wildlife health and disease can be an indicator of possible problems for everyone. And
yes.
I actually wrote down the quote here. Just like the CDC, which goes to where people are sick in order to identify outbreaks of disease, the Wildlife Center looks for abnormal patterns to find the roots of outbreaks. Tell me more about that.
Well, for many years, the Wildlife Center has been not only interested in the care of individual animals, but in the patterns of disease that occur. Some of the earliest examples of that, we began to find multiple bald eagles that were poisoned by the same chemical. Yes, it was important to care for the individual animals, but once we began to gain the awareness that the problem wasn't the eagles, the problem was the pesticide. Caring for the individual eagles was putting a Band-Aid on the symptom, not treating the disease. The disease, as we came to find out, was that this particular pesticide had been brought onto the market in the United States using bad test data and using inappropriate, if not overtly illegal, registration procedures. And it took us many years, but with the cooperation of many organizations and the strong cooperation of the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries in this, we eventually got this chemical banned in Virginia. It was the first enforcement action taken by the newly convened Virginia Pesticide Control Board. They banned this chemical in Virginia because of the impact on wildlife, and within 72 hours, the product was withdrawn nationwide. And we come back and say, how did we get onto this? It all started with one bird. It started with one eagle. We knew it was poison. Treating the poison, which we successfully did, was important. But had we stopped there, the true problem would have been a long time in the discovery. And as the investigation continued, we found that that one chemical was killing 2 million birds per year when used according to label directions across the United States. So through the investigation of the case of one bird, we discovered a threat that had been killing 2 million annually, and we were able to address the true root of the problem and get that chemical off the market.
He is the co-founder and current leader of the wildlife advocacy and rescue operation that began its work 32 years ago. Ed Clark, president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, is our guest. At some point in the recent past, the Wildlife Center was looking into chronic wasting disease, which I understand was a threat to wild deer, sort of a wild deer version of mad cow disease, and at one point was worrying many hunters.
Still is. Probably more so now than at our last discussion. We have this disease in Virginia, thanks to our friends in West Virginia, who have a very active captive deer farming, what is called by many canned hunting operations, deer confinement operations, where people pay a fee, go in to hunt inside a fenced area where the deer are managed to produce trophy animals. Unfortunately, in that growing industry of deer farming and captive hunting opportunities, there is very little regulation, and these animals are being moved around the United States with very little in the way of health checks, very little in the way of regulatory control, and almost no record keeping. And what we have seen is where the disease is popping up is, with one exception of which I'm aware, is all in the states where these captive deer farms take place and are legal. Here in Virginia, at least 25 years ago, the Commonwealth of Virginia's Wildlife Agency, our Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, and truly a prescient and very, very wise decision, passed regulation banning the importation of any type of deer to Virginia. And this means no zoo, no farmer, no pet owner, no anything. It can bring in any form of deer into the state, period. And that kept this disease out until our neighboring state of West Virginia, as I said, this stuff showed up in one of the captive deer herds just west of Winchester and passed into the wild herd, since most of these confinement operations include only a single fence. So nose-to-nose contact, the disease was out, and once it was out, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. So we now have this disease in the western portion of Frederick and Shenandoah counties in Virginia. There are very, very strict regulations on the harvesting of animals up there and the movement of animals. Deer fawns that are found in that quarantine area cannot be taken out of the area to be rehabilitated. They have to be rehabilitated by the one rehabber in that area. And free testing is offered. Now, the truth is we don't know that this disease poses any threat to humans at all. But then again, until it showed up in humans, we didn't know mad cow disease was a problem. So there is free testing available if a hunter does harvest the deer and wishes to have that animal tested anywhere near the known area of infection. The state will provide that test free of charge.
Next to Ivy. Bob, thanks for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Ed Clark of the Wildlife Center of Virginia, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Ed, this is Bob, your long, long, long time friend.
Hey, Bob.
I've enjoyed hearing what you all are talking about here this afternoon very, very much. And you hit the nail on the head a while ago and about how you raise funds for NGOs or nonprofits. And I would like to urge all the listeners who are listening to this program and understand what you're saying and support what you're saying to donate to the Virginia Center for Wildlife. Thanks a lot.
Well, Bob, I didn't put you up to that, but if I had thought of it, I might have. I appreciate your vote of confidence. We actually have a saying around the Wildlife Center, and people don't believe us that we really think this way, but when people donate money to the Wildlife Center, we don't think of it as becoming our money. The money still belongs to the donor. It's simply entrusted to us to use wisely, to use well, to use effectively and efficiently to achieve the goals and advance the mission of the organization. And then it's our responsibility to report back to the donor on exactly what we've done with their support and what impact it they have had through their support of the Wildlife Center.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. I think we've got time for one more. Let's go to Waynesboro. Larry, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question, your comment for Ed Clark, please.
Hi. Yes, Ed. I live about a quarter of a mile from the Wildlife Center. And in the last 2 years, I've noticed a lot of bears that have been in the area, especially in the alleys, after food in the trash cans. And I was wondering why there's so many bears now. 10 years ago, you never saw a bear, but today, now there's so many bears. I know you have a lot of bears in the Wildlife Center. Is the food less in the forest, or what's the main problem?
Well, Larry, that's a question we've been getting a lot lately, and it's really it's number one. You're exactly right. We are seeing more bears around. We're seeing more of them in town, and there are two reasons for that. Over the last several years, probably 5 to 10 years, the black bear population of Virginia, which is a great conservation success story, has been growing at the last number that I heard was about 9% per year. And that population is expanding all over the state. And we're finding black bears in almost every single municipality in Virginia at one time or another. Now, the reason we've been getting so many in town, and particularly in so many communities that are close to more appropriate bear habitats, towns like Waynesboro and Crozet and even Charlottesville to some extent, is because in the last year, we have had a catastrophic failure of the acorn crop in the forests of Virginia and indeed of the Appalachians. We have seen in the last 3 years two absolutely bumper crops of acorns in the winter of 2011-12. And then 12-13, we just had acorns everywhere. And as a result of the abundant food, populations went up, animals survived and thrived through the winters. And then this past year, in the winter of 2013-14, there was nearly a complete collapse of the acorn crop. One figure I heard from a forester with our state wildlife agency was that the failure was 95%. That meant that the primary food source for these animals, and not just bears, for deer, for wild turkey, squirrels, many others, that food source was gone. These animals were simply desperate for food, and they were coming out looking for food anywhere they could find it. And if it happened to be somebody's trash can or a can of dog food or a bag of dog food in somebody's garage, these animals were starving. And in fact, earlier this year, in January, February, and March of 2014, the Wildlife Center received 11 year-old bear cubs, the smallest of which weighed less than 10 pounds. And these animals were quite literally starving to death as a result of this crop failure. So yes, you're seeing them. We hope this year is going to be better. It's a little too soon to tell. But the best thing we can suggest is keep the food sources in a secure place, and hopefully nature will balance itself and these bears will go back to the woods.
Larry, thanks so much for your call. Here on Facebook, Carrie, I apologize for truncating your question, but we've only got about 30 seconds. So basically, Carrie's saying, you're wonderful. The center is wonderful. What's next?
Just to be more wonderful, I hope. But indeed, the Wildlife Center is in the current strategic planning mode. We're looking 3 to 4 years down the road. We know we're going to be expanding our online presence. We hope to be enhancing our delivery of training programs through online media, improving our critter cams, and making it more and more possible for people to engage with the Wildlife Center, to support us easily, seamlessly, and to become our partners in teaching the world to care about and care for wildlife and the environment.
Our guest has been Ed Clark, founder and president of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Ed, as always, it's a delight. Thanks so very much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom. I look forward to being with you again.
Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you'll see links to more information about Mr. Clark, the Wildlife Center, and the work going on there. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.